up to this time, the 49th group had been flying P-40Es, like Echo, and P-40Ks, but on the 2nd of August, this is 1943, I came back from a mission one day to find that we had gotten 11 brand new P-40Ms. This was significant in that it's always been my experience that when the Air Corps brought out a new model of airplane, it always, of course, had improvements in it. But there was always the tendency to add more and more stuff on them, on the airplanes, to make them heavier and slower and less maneuverable. And another tendency was to encumber the things with a lot of automatic devices, which on earlier models those functions had been performed manually. And the automatic devices frequently didn't work very well and were more of a nuisance than a benefit. Well, the P-40N was markedly different from any earlier P-40, and the Air Corps had not, in this instance, fallen for those deceptive improvements. I think probably in dimensions and all, the airplane was the same size as the earlier P-40s. If it wasn't, it was a mite smaller, but I kind of doubt that. But in any case, they were quite different. They had considerably improved visibility from the cockpit, especially to the rear, by adding more glass and taking away more metal. And some devices that had heretofore been automatic were now manual. And that was all right. That could be handled very well. I forget what else they had done, but the airplane was noticeably lighter. It was noticeably faster. It was noticeably more maneuverable. And it was more fun to fly. They, meaning the Air Corps, in their effort to simplify things and lighten the airplane, they had... they made one mistake. They took the self-starters off of these airplanes. I have to explain for the benefit of some people that in those days, all the airplanes I was familiar with, in the Air Corps anyway, had inertia starters, they were called. And I don't know that much about them except that they consisted of a little, and very heavy, I suppose, flywheel, which was energized electrically and would start to spin until it got up to an extremely high speed, and it really let out a loud whine. And at that point, when it got as fast as it would go, you would then engage it with the engine. And it would turn the engine over rapidly for several revolutions, and in ordinary cases, enough to get it started. But in this case, they had taken off the inertia. They hadn't taken off the inertia starter, actually. They had taken off the electrical energizer for it. So it meant that the engines had to be started by cranking them by hand. Now, they didn't crank the engine directly. They still had an inertia starter, but the mechanic or the pilot or somebody had to crank it up. And this was hard, especially at first. You had to turn very hard to get the thing going. Once you got it up to some speed, it turned fairly easily. But all this was time-consuming. And well, on scrambles, when we had to get off the ground in a hurry, of course, it delayed us probably... better part of a minute getting those engines started on all those airplanes. And that was a mistake. And I might add while I'm at it that it didn't take too long, a couple months, before the mistake was seen as a mistake and the hand cranking device was supplemented by an electric energizer. What you would do starting those things, incidentally, there was a toggle switch which had three positions. It was off in the middle. And if you pushed it to the up position, it was labeled energized, and then electric motor would start winding up this little flywheel. And when it got going as fast as it'd go, then you flicked the toggle switch to the down position, which was labeled engage, and that was just like pressing the starter on a car. That turned the engine over, and as soon as it started to fire, you put the toggle switch back into the neutral or center position. Anyway, these P-40Ns were, by and large, a great improvement over the old ones, and we were delighted to have them. First place, we had pretty well worn out the old P-40s anyway, and we were due for new airplanes, period. But to get new airplanes that were a definite improvement over the old ones was, we thought, a splendid thing. It was also long about this time that my friend Smitty, Snuffy Smith, got transferred to the 90th Bomb Group. He knew that he was going to be transferred, and he hoped he would be transferred to a transport unit. But he wasn't. He and another guy named Newman from the 8th Squadron were both transferred to the 90th Bomb Group. The 90th Bomb Group was flying B-25s. And that was dangerous business. But turned out all right. One day, during this same period, I had got a rebuilt engine put into my airplane, number 31, and had to take it up for a test hop. The engine had only about 19 hours on it. And I had no sooner got well into the air before the oil pressure started going up and up, and it climbed very, very fast, and I could see that that the engine was going to run out of oil pressure any moment, and shortly thereafter would just seize up and quit. And fortunately, I was able to make a 180-degree turn and get back down to the ground. But I was not able to, or at least I didn't even try, I guess, able to get back to the taxi, back to the far end of the runway. I just, as soon as I touched the ground, I shut the engine off so I wouldn't ruin it. And when its airplane slowed down, I pulled off the side of the strip and they came out and towed it in. And as it turned out, one of the bearings had gone and the oil filter was filled with the metal filings. Well, this wasn't altogether a bad thing in that 3 days later, they gave me a brand new engine and a new propeller as well. On the 10th of August, I was sent down with Jack Farrell and various other pilots to Brisbane, Australia, to ferry back some more new P-40Ns. There were at least two airfields west of the city of Brisbane. Brisbane's a pretty large city, actually. Way out west was Archer Field, which was belonged to the RAAF. Although I'm not sure they were doing any flying on that field, but the Americans had taken it over, and it was a large permanent base with long runways and so forth. And one of the people that used Archer Field was the Air Transport Command, and they were the people who flew C-54s, which were really DC-4s, C-54s back and forth between Australia and the United States. And they had a fairly large establishment there. There were lots of airplanes at Archer Field. It was a base with a lot of activity going on. But it must have been about, I don't know what, but 25 or 30 miles west of the city. Then in between Archer Field and the city was a small field, probably, I think, built entirely by the Americans. I don't think in my first days in Australia that second field existed. It was called Eagle Farm, and that field was used exclusively, as far as I know, for the assembly of new airplanes, which would be fighter planes, because the bombers were always flown over. But the fighters were sent over in crates, dismantled, and they were assembled at Eagle Farm and tested and readied for flight. And I believe that Eagle Farm was probably the place where Allison had its engine rebuild facility. Now, that would have been the logical place for it, and I think it was there. So we were sent down to Brisbane to bring back these new P-40s. But the first few days we were there, it poured rain all the time, and we couldn't do anything or go anywhere. We stayed at a hotel in town, and that sounds rather fancy, but I call these places hotels, even though maybe they didn't merit that description. It was like really a large private house with a lot of bedrooms, and run by a couple, a married couple, and a few servants, I guess. And they had a dining room and a kitchen, but I doubt if more than 8 or 10 people could stay there. I don't think they had accommodations for more than that. We kind of took it over while we were there, and it was relatively inexpensive, and they provided us with a place to sleep and a place to eat. And it was very convenient. I remember one time, well, I guess this occurred later. I'm getting ahead of myself. Anyway, when the time came for us to go back to New Guinea with the new airplanes, we all were taken out to Eagle Farm and assigned an airplane, which we had to sign for. They made you sign for this, that you had taken delivery of this thing. Don't know what we'd have done if we'd lost the slip. Anyway, the practice was always the same. They would not let fighters fly back to New Guinea alone. There was a navigational problem, perhaps. Perhaps. But they certainly weren't going to let those single-engine fighters fly directly from Brisbane to Port Moresby, because that would have meant a couple hours of in completely overwater flight. So what the route was that you flew up the east coast of Australia as far as you could go, and if you look at a map, you'll see that gets you pretty close to New Guinea, and then out to a little bitty island in the straits between Australia and New Guinea called Horn Island, where the RAAF had an airstrip. That's all it was. And you'd land there and refuel, and then the remaining portion, we did fly direct to Port Moresby, and it meant it was all over water, but you were still within sight of land, and the longer you flew, the closer to land you got. Well, these flights of this sort were always led by a bomber, generally a B-25, but you had a bomber who led you up there, and you had to stick with him and do what he did and go where he told you. Well, we took off, all of us, I don't know how many, 8 or 10 of us, I suppose, on this mission. But after half an hour or less of flight, my propeller went out, or showed signs of doing so, and I had to turn back. And I went on back to Eagle Farm, and of course, fixing the problem was not a big deal, but they wouldn't let people go back, fighters go back alone, or even singly. They had to wait till a bunch. It wasn't worthwhile to send a bomber up to New Guinea to escort just one fighter. They wanted to wait till there were a bunch of them. So I was, shall we say, stuck in Brisbane until some more people came down to get some more airplanes so I could go back with a group. And I had a rather nice time there. I got a lot of good food, and I went to some concerts. And I remember one time I went to a concert of the Brisbane Symphony, and I don't remember what the details were, but I did go backstage and met the conductor, who invited me to a party of some kind. And I suppose I went, though I have no recollection of it. Anyway, I had a very nice time there, doing nothing much but eating and sleeping a lot and amusing myself. And in the course of time, probably 2 weeks or more, more guys from the squadron appeared, and we had to wait till they had enough airplanes. I remember once some of us who had nothing to do and wanted to fly, we went out to Eagle Farm and said we wanted to slow time some of the new airplanes. Well, they had some idiot asshole of a second lieutenant there who was in charge of all this, and he said indeed not. He wouldn't trust us with a P-40. And we said, well, we were flew P-40s in New Guinea and didn't know why. No, sir, he said, I don't know anything about you guys. You're not flying any of my airplanes. And so he wouldn't let us do it, silly ass. Of course, in the end, he turned them over to us, but that didn't seem to make any difference to him. Another time, I remember, perhaps it was the same time, I don't know, we went out there with three or four of us, and we started back about dark, riding in the back of a truck to Brisbane, and another guy and I had been drinking beer, and we had to pee, but of course we couldn't because we were riding in this truck. But the urgency became greater and greater as time went on, and finally it became damn near unbearable, and it got dark. And I remember telling this other guy, I said, well, I tell you, I'm just going to stand up in the back of this truck and pee out over the tailgate, if you will. He said, well, yeah, he would too, but we just never could somehow get up nerve enough to actually do this, and we didn't. And when we finally got back into town and at the hotel, I remember that I could hardly get out of that truck. I could hardly move. And I've had to pee badly plenty of times in my life, but never anything like that. It was excruciating. I'll never forget that incident. Well, eventually we all took off behind a B-25 for New Guinea, and this time I had no problems. But when we got to Horn Island, we arrived right in the middle of a tropical rainstorm, and we barely made it because it rained so hard that the visibility was reduced to practically zero, and we barely got in on that strip. And I remember being absolutely enraged with somebody, whoever landed in front of me, when it was urgent to get his airplanes on the ground as fast as we could before it became absolutely impossible. He just taxied like a goddamn snail down the runway, and I remember calling him every name in the book. Anyway, happily, everybody got on the ground safely, but it was impossible to proceed any further that day. Well, there were accommodations there, so we didn't care. And then, late in the afternoon, the sun came out and it was warm, and the Aussies who ran this base, if you want to call it a base, the staging base, I suppose you'd call it. I don't know. Anyway, they took us swimming, and there was great danger from sharks. But the swimming place that we went had rocks around it between the open sea and this sort of cove or inlet or something, so that sharks couldn't get in. And it was enormously deep. I don't know how deep, 20, 30 feet maybe, and very big. And the most beautiful, warm, clear water you ever saw in your life. And we spent a couple hours there just swimming around in this bathtub, practically, except it was huge. And we had a completely delightful time. When I got back, next day we went on back to Port Moresby and delivered the airplanes, and I was quite happy to be home, what I considered home anyway at that time. Again, to see everybody, and I had a huge batch of letters waiting for me. It also turned out that one of the pilots, a man named David Baker, had lost his mind, so to speak, and not so to speak either, I guess, and had to be put away. That is to say, he was sent to hospital, as the Aussies would say. But as far as the war years are concerned, that ended that. But I think I'll interject the rest of that story here while I'm at it. These were things that I found out when I worked for the VA many, many years later. David Baker escaped from the hospital, and he went down to Australia. He went down to Sydney. And he had moments of sanity, more than moments, evidently. And he was wily. He was sly as a fox. And he hung around down there, and when people from our squadron would go down there on leave, he would get money from them and manage to live. And in some fashion, he managed to forge a set of orders and got himself on a boat, some sort of merchant vessel that took him back to San Francisco. And then he worked his way back to Baltimore, Maryland, where he turned himself in to the authorities or something, and they locked him up or put him in the hospital or something. Anyway, David Baker spent the next 30-odd years in and out of mental hospitals, VA hospitals. And in the summer of 1980, when the 49th Fighter Group had their annual reunion in San Francisco, and I was in charge of the arrangements for this affair, I got a letter one day from David Baker saying he heard we were going to have a reunion, and he wanted to come. Well, David had a record of being violent when he was crazy and half killing people. And he was kind of like a bull. He was short and tremendously husky and tremendously powerful. And he was a dangerous person if he wanted to be. And I had read his record in his VA files, so I knew that that I didn't want him to come to the reunion. So I wrote a letter to the VA hospital and said that David Baker had written to me and told me that he intended to attend our reunion, and I wanted to know whether or not he could be considered responsible and so on or not. Well, of course, what I was asking for was medical information, which was something the VA was not at liberty to give. And I got a very amusing letter from the hospital. And the director said that he'd gotten my letter, and he said that, of course, it was impossible for him to give me any of the information that I asked for. He was sorry, but that was the way it was. And then he added in the second paragraph, "I think it extremely unlikely that David Baker will be attending a reunion in San Francisco this month or any other time," which in effect told me what I wanted to know. And I was considerably relieved. I forgot to say that David had been writing to me, incidentally, several times before he announced his intention of coming to the reunion. And I had answered his letters and all that, and he always treated me as some long-lost friend, though I'd never been much of a friend of his at any time. But anyway, the reunion got underway one afternoon, and about supper time or late in the afternoon, I was talking to some people, and somebody came up to me and said, "Harry, your friend David Baker is out there. He wants to see you." And my heart sunk. Well, there was David, looking the same as he always had, a bit older perhaps, but not much different. He was dressed in a green velvet suit. And gave me some story about having been robbed when he got to the city, and though he had no money, and I told him that was all right, he didn't need any money, we'd see to that, and so on. In fact, I gave him $50. And to make a long story short, I guess, David stayed throughout the reunion, and he was never any trouble to anybody. He was quite subdued and rather quiet and decidedly pathetic. He would say things to you, did I tell you my son died? Did you know my son died? Yeah, my favorite son, he died. My son died. Did I tell you that? Did I tell you my son died? Yeah, my favorite boy, he died. My son died. And I assume he escaped from the VA hospital somehow, I don't know. But when the reunion was over, he disappeared. But about a month later, I got a letter from him with a check for $50, and the check was good. And anyway, I was relieved to see the last of him. All during this time, we were doing the usual exceedingly tedious escorting of C-47s back and forth to places like Leh and Wau and Morobe and Nadzab and God knows where else. The situation in general with us vis-a-vis the Air Force people in Europe was that in Europe they were mostly scared of the Germans, and with good reason. Whereas in New Guinea, we were mostly scared of the jungle, because if you ever went down in the jungle, you didn't stand too good a chance of getting out. though a lot of people did, I must say. Sometimes it took them a month or 2 months, but sometimes they came back. Much the worse for wear, I may say, but they came back and lived to tell about it. But that was the big problem. We had a lot of instruction from people about what to do if we went down. But no matter how you cut it, there wasn't anything very good about it. And we always dreaded that. The luckiest thing that could happen to you would be that you would go down near the coast. Then you really stood some chance of getting back, even though you had to walk all the way or most of the way. At least you wouldn't be trying to chop your way through the jungle. There was very little problem where the natives were concerned. The natives were...